Next on American Dream Radio, Reese Ehrlich. Reese Ehrlich is the co-author, along with Norman Solomon, of the book Target Iraq, What the News Media is Not Telling Us. Mr. Ehrlich is introduced by Steve Scalmanini at a public event in Ukiah, California on June 10th, 2003.
Tonight's speaker is journalist Reese Ehrlich, who's been reporting around 35 years or so on events, foreign events, and doing it in news media and radio media predominantly, including one of his recent stories that has been selected by the Project Censored group down at Sonoma State University as one of the top 30 most censored stories of 2003. And among the 40 or so countries that he's visited over the years has been Iraq, which was last fall, and the experience of which led to a book published in the earlier this year with co-author Norm Solomon titled Target Iraq, What the News Media is Not Telling Us. And those books are here on sale tonight, and Reese will do a signing after the program. Now that a long occupation is possibly underway, here's our opportunity to hear more about what's really going on in very recent events there and how the media is reporting it. And after the address, we'll have time for question and answer and some open discussion among us. So please welcome Reese Ehrlich.
We'll do this informally, and I always like to leave plenty of room, plenty of time for questions and answers at the end. First, I just wanted to note that in Sunday's New York Times, this is the style section, there just happens to be a front page article about our publisher, Context Books, and about our book. And on the inside, on page 12, there's a very nice photo of our book, Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. And I just want to take this opportunity to say that I've stopped all of my criticisms of the New York Times. I think it's just a wonderful newspaper. And I plan to go to work for them soon. On a more serious note, I reported from Iraq last September. I wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle, the Dallas Morning News, CBC in Canada, the World, and reported and saw certain things that and at the time, and unfortunately, have become obviously all too true. And among them were the fact that it was pretty obvious that the Iraqi government did not have weapons of mass destruction that were an actual threat to anybody, let alone to the United States. That was obvious before the war ever started. And I remember very well the April speech that Colin Powell gave before the United Nations. You remember he had satellite photos and wiretap intercepts and secret intelligence documents and made this huge case about the existence of the weapons of mass destruction, tens of thousands of gallons of poison gas and nuclear weapons and all of these things, and that in somehow Iraq was an imminent threat to the people of the region and to the people of the United States. That Iraq had ties with al-Qaeda and so on and so forth. And the U.S. media universally lapped it up. Front page stories of the New York Times, CNN, you name it, Washington Post, anybody and everybody, proclaimed what a powerful case he had made to show the fact that the basically the war was justified because of all these weapons of mass destruction. Well, you know, we can go back, that was all of April. How many months ago was that, right? And we can go back and we now know there wasn't a single example that he cited in that speech that turned out to be true. Not a single one. Reporters or UN inspectors or American soldiers, specialists, have gone to every single one of those sites, have investigated every single one of those things, and turned out every single one of them was false. So the idea, you know, I think probably the most powerful argument that convinced people in this country to go to war was, look, our government has information that they can't reveal to us. That, you know, he is this guy, he's this dangerous guy, we've got to go to war to stop him, trust us, we're the government. And now it turns out every single justification for the war turned out to be a lie. Now the one example that they cling to is that they found two trucks, two mobile labs that the U.S. claims are used, could be used for biological, developing biological weapons. And the Iraqis say no, they're made to manufacture hydrogen. And the U.S. says, oh, no, those sneaky Iraqis, we know that if you disconnected the pipe here at the top and you reconnected a pipe down here at the bottom and had a different drainage system and brought in a steam cleaning system from the outside, I'm not making any of this up. Those are all that if they only did those things, this would for sure be a place that they could develop horrible, horrible biological toxins, which wouldn't yet be ready for weapons. But if they took it to another secret location, it could be ready for weapons. And that proves that the war was justified and they have weapons of mass destruction. Sunday, just this last Sunday, London Observer, mainstream daily paper. What did they reveal? You know those two trucks? They were sold to the Iraqis by the British in 1987. And what was the purpose of those trucks? Hold on to your seats. This is shocking. To manufacture hydrogen. Manufacture hydrogen for use in artillery balloons. You know, you pump up balloons and that's it. In other words, everything that the Iraqis had been saying all along turns out to be true. And yet, I can't say, because I've been traveling the last couple of days, I can't say how much this story has been covered, but certainly it was important news in Britain, but I doubt very seriously that it's made. Had any of you heard about this, about the fact that the British sold these trucks? No. It's okay, one person in the whole, and you probably got it from the internet, right? Okay. So it just gives you an indication that when the lies spread around the world and the truth takes many, many months or years to actually percolate out in the U.S. The other, you know, let's just go through some of the other claims of the administration. Do you remember on the opening day of the war, we started the war early because we could target Saddam Hussein's bunker, and we hit a missile there and we killed Saddam Hussein? And for days afterwards, they were saying, we got him, we killed him. And then he showed up on the streets of Baghdad, do you remember that one, in a video? And they said, must be his body double. And then after the war, he's issued audio tapes. We still got him. Now it turns out, not only is he not dead, there was no bunker. There was no bunker. So the whole premise of the opening of the war and what a heroic victory it was going to be, that one's tossed out the window. Because reporters have now gone to that site and they said, hey, no bunker. All right. Now, the other one, Private Jessica Lynch. Do you remember in roughly the second, third week of the war when things were going very badly for the U.S., when it appeared that the U.S. Was getting attacked much more vigorously than they had anticipated? Suddenly we had the rescue of Private Lynch, and what a great moment that was for America. We could all feel proud of the great job that our soldiers had done. Now, I assume some of you are familiar with this because the BBC has now done an expose on that. But, you know, just to briefly reiterate it, what they did is they actually went back and they checked with the doctors and the personnel in the hospital there. It turns out, A, Jessica Lynch was never shot or stabbed, as claimed. She had injuries consistent with a vehicle accident. In other words, her vehicle crashed and she was not shot. They say she was never mistreated. They say that the doctors gave her blood, gave her their own blood, that the guards had abandoned the hospital days before the raid, so it was completely unguarded, and that, in fact, the doctors themselves had put her into an ambulance and taken her to the U.S. lines in an effort to deliver her back to the U.S. soldiers, and the U.S. soldiers shot at the ambulance, so they had to turn around and come back. Okay, and then the day of the heroic rescue, remember, there's no guards there. So they go in, and again, according to the BBC, they were firing blanks to make it look dramatic. And the U.S. military has a videotape of the entire incident, but of course they will refuse to reveal that because they only revealed the edited version to make the U.S. troops look so heroic. Now, this is not only a problem for the U.S. administration, kind of caught fabricating, hyping stuff, but the NBC has bought the rights for a made-for-TV movie. You know about that one? There's a book that's going to be published, animated for TV movie. So now they have a problem. Again, this has been in the media. They have a problem that What story do they tell? Do they tell the official Pentagon version, which everybody's going to say, yeah. Or, and this is my humble suggestion to them, I've offered them a screenplay, in which they actually tell the truth. Wouldn't it be much more interesting if it turned out to be that they were telling the real story of the Pentagon cover-up? You know, and then we get Steven Seagal to play the heroic second lieutenant, and Julia Roberts to do the Jessica Lynch thing, and then they're attacked by, well, anyway, you can get the idea. So, but somehow, I don't think that's going to be the version that comes out on the made-for-TV movie. I think it's going to be the propaganda version that the U.S. military would prefer. And then, of course, the one that caps of all the lies, the one that caps the puts the candle on the cake, is, of course, the claim that Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons. Now, what was this based on? And this was cited by the British government. It was cited by Colin Powell in his April speech, and it was cited by President Bush in his State of the Union address, which is that the Iraqi government had purchased yellow cake, which is a form of uranium that can be easily used for manufacturing nuclear weapons, had purchased it from the African country of Niger. And that this proved that he was trying to rebuild his nuclear weapons program. And the British went so far as to say that he had the capability to launch an attack on Britain within 45 minutes. Okay. Now, the U.S. refused to give up this document to the U.N. weapons inspectors. Finally, just before the war, they actually got a hold of the document. And again, in a story that was published in the New Yorker magazine, but otherwise not widely circulated, it turns out that the U.N. inspectors used highly sophisticated techniques in order to show what this document really was. They did a Google search, and they turned out that the document was a complete forgery. That as a result of the Google search and some other highly sophisticated methods, they figured out that the guy who signed the letter as the Minister of Energy, allegedly of Niger, wasn't even in power on the date that the letter was issued. So what somebody had done was take some old letterhead, cut it up, paste it in the signature, and wrote in a phony letter and passed it off as real. Now, this passed through the MI6 in Britain, through the CIA. President Bush cited in his speech. Now, there's one of two things that are very, very problematic here. Either we've got a bunch of doofi running the CIA that didn't bother to do a Google search on this document, or they intentionally passed off this document in order to scare people, figuring, hey, who's going to catch us? You know, and that when you look at all of these things cumulatively, the Jessica Lynch phony thing, the weapons of mass destruction, the yellow cake in Niger, et cetera, you know, think Watergate. Did Nixon ever figure he was going to get caught? No. So he said all these things. He never figured that the tapes were going to be revealed or that his insiders would spill the beans. He was in power. He was at the top of his game. So he did all of these evil things of you know, office break-ins and checking, you know, breaking in the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist, and, you know, using the IRS to attack his enemies, putting media people on the enemies list. I mean, all of these clearly illegal, unconstitutional things, figuring, hey, I'm the president, I ain't going to get caught. Well, Bush is doing the exact same thing. This whole run-up, they decided that they were going to go to war, and then they just kind of cooked up some reasons along the way. And now that all of this stuff is starting to come out, they're all scrambling to try and explain it. Because it's not only people in the United States, but people in Europe and the Middle East and the rest of the world are saying, hey, you went to war unilaterally. You went to war unilaterally to stop the weapons of mass destruction, and there aren't any. What gives? So then you get these funny explanations, like, you know, Paul Wolfowitz, known better as Wolfowitz of Arabia. He now says in an interview that it was for bureaucratic reasons that we decided on weapons of mass destruction. And what does that mean? It means that there were four or five different possible reasons. The implication is he didn't really think that the weapons of mass destruction was that big a deal, but he went along with it, and that's the one that everybody could agree to, even though there were other ones. Now, this is just classic butt covering.
You are listening to Reese Ehrlich, author of the book Target Iraq, What the News Media Is Not Telling Us, speaking in Ukiah, California on June 10th, 2003. This is American Dream Radio.
I mean, that's all it is to it, because what's happening is nobody wants to be the last one standing when the music stops. See, it's you, Wolfowitz, you're out. All right. Nobody wants that. So they're all trying to come up with their own explanations, and same thing within the CIA. You know, you have all these intelligence officers who are now saying, they're leaking, you know, off-the-record interviews to the New York Times and Washington Post. You know, I really told them the truth. I never really thought that weapons of mass destruction thing, and they took it and they distorted it. You know, okay, that may or may not be true, but where were these guys before the war started? See, where were the leaks saying that the information is being distorted beforehand? They're doing it now for one specific reason. The war ain't going the way they planned. The war was supposed to be over. The U.S. troops were supposed to be coming home. The Iraqi people were supposed to be strewing flowers in our path. And it's quite obvious that that is not the case. That the U.S. is going to be bogged down in Iraq for many years to come. That this was, yes, a military victory to defeat Saddam Hussein. That was not difficult. I knew that from my visit to Iraq, because he was a very unpopular dictator. But now the U.S. is responsible for everything that goes on in Iraq, from the electricity to restoring the looted items to the National Museum to rebuilding the hospitals, the schools, etc., from settling the disputes among the various ethnic, political, religious factions in Iraq. That's all the U.S. job now, because it is the occupying power. And of course, now the U.S. says, well, look, alright, maybe we can't find any weapons of mass destruction, but we probably will. Maybe we haven't actually found any real links to Al-Qaeda, but Saddam Hussein was a horrible dictator, and look over here at these mass graves. That's the argument, which is don't look at what we said before, look at what we're saying now. And he was a horrible dictator, he killed all these people, and we're going to bring democracy so the war was okay. Well, that is the ultimate hypocritical and phony argument. Because, yes, of course he was a horrible dictator. I don't know anybody who saw him as some kind of model Democrat or thought Iraq was some kind of great society. I've yet to meet anybody. Even the people inside the higher-ups of Iraq, you know, if they were talking to you honestly, wouldn't even make that argument. But the idea that a foreign power can come in and bring democracy, the only thing that's going on is the goodwill of the American people. We are a good, decent people. And we think that our sentiments for, you know, free speech and constitutional rights and trying to get on, try and have some kind of ethnic peace, that somehow that will be transmuted from the U.S. military to the Iraqi people, and therefore they will be better off. But the reality of it is the U.S. has absolutely no intention of installing a democracy in Iraq. One, where the hell else have we ever done it? Certainly never in the Middle East, in the Arab Middle East. We name a single democracy of all the countries the United States supports. Where have we helped promote democracy? In fact, it's just the opposite. Every time somebody, a democratically elected government, comes to power that's critical of the U.S., we overthrow them and install a dictatorship. Iran, Iraq under the Ba'athists, you know. Why? Hey, the dictatorship is fine so long as they kill communists and other people we don't like, nationalists and whatever. So we're not interested in democracy. And if you need a specific example, right, very concrete today, let's look at the city of Kirkuk. Kirkuk is in the north of Iraq. It's an oil-rich area in which the Kurds historically have lived there. Roughly 20 years ago, 25 years ago, Saddam Hussein kicked the Kurds out and started a process of what he called Arabization, that is, bringing in Iraqi Arabs from other parts of Iraq to live and literally taking over the houses of the people of the Kurds. It was a horrible kind of semi-ethnic cleansing situation, which, of course, at the time, since he was a U.S. ally, the U.S. said nothing about. Now, fast forward to today. The war is over. The Kurds, the two Kurdish parties, are allied with the United States. Then they're sending their militias into Kirkuk, and they're literally physically evicting the Arabs who've lived there for 20, 25 years, throwing them out of the houses and bringing Kurds in. Okay? So guaranteed to create animosities for years to come, right? Absolutely guaranteed. I mean, there's obviously got to be a resolution of that, but you don't do it by armed force and simply throwing people, saying, literally telling people, you've got 24 hours to get out. We're moving people into your house that you've lived in. Now, the U.S. now brags of the fact that it has a city council and a mayor democratically elected in Kirkuk. Well, look at the details of it. There was not, like, such minor details as like voter registration and a popular vote. No, that never happened. They got together a bunch of people and had them vote on a council. You know, they voted for a council, and then the council was going to vote for a mayor. But even that one didn't work because after they held the elections for the council, the U.S. didn't like the results. So what did they do? They arrested five of the members of this newly elected council and said they were former Ba'athist Party members and threw them off the council because they happened to be in jail. Now, what did that do? That just, by sheer coincidence, tipped the scales so that a Kurd from the party that the U.S. supports got elected mayor. So we've now got a Kurdish mayor and a Kurdish majority on the council of Kirkuk. So, yeah, we're exporting democracy to Iraq, democracy Florida style. Now, why is it that so much of the kind of information that I've explained today either doesn't come out in the U.S. media or comes out in ways that its impact is lessened? A number of the things that I've cited just now, you can find, if you could do a careful reading of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or other major media, you can find articles that mention one or of the other things that I've just said, with some exceptions. However, that's not the general impression. If you went out and talked to your average American who reads a newspaper or watches the media, the impression they would have is the U.S. won the war. We were on the right side. We got rid of a horrible dictatorship. We're helping to build democracy, but we're having some problems. I'd say that would be the majority. Okay, now, so why is it that that reality is so different from, or that perception is so different from the reality on the ground in Iraq? Okay, I've been a reporter for roughly 35 years. I've been a foreign correspondent since roughly 1980. I have traveled 40 plus countries, and in those countries I frequently interact with, meet, and go have a beer with folks from the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, etc. And I talk to them and get a sense over the years. They'll talk to a fellow reporter in ways that they would not talk to you and certainly would never admit in the media. And there's a whole chapter in the book that goes into much greater length explaining this. But the short version of it is that A, there's a tremendous ideological agreement with the assumptions of empire by those reporters who've made it up to the elite level of being a foreign correspondent. It's not somebody who gets hired fresh out of college who ends up reporting from Iraq. You've got people who've been 10, 20 years as reporters. They're making very good money. If you're working full-time for a major newspaper or NPR or somebody like that, you're making $90,000 to $125,000 a year, a tad over your kind of average Ukiah wage. If you're working for TV, you're making 2, 3, 4 times that amount, depending on what network it is and so on. So, first of all, you're already fairly high up in the corporate ladder, as it were. And I did not meet a single reporter in all of my time in Iraq and since, of the mainstream press, that thought the U.S. had no right to choose what government there should be in Iraq. Every single one of them thought either. Now, they differed on tactics. Some people supported the war, some people opposed the war. But that was a question of tactics, military force. They all, if they opposed the war, supported sanctions. And the idea being that some deity has anointed the United States with the power to go around saying, you're a legitimate government, you're not a legitimate government, we're going to overthrow you and occupy you, and we're going to pressure you with sanctions, and we're going to threaten you, and this is okay. This is the assumption of empire. This is what every empire, from the Romans to the British to the French, you name it, or the Americans in this country with their oppression of the Native Americans, that's exactly what they do, which is, we go in, we want your land, get out. Right? So that assumption is shared by the people at the upper ends of the media. Secondly, they learn how to play the game. There's certain sources that are legitimate and certain sources that are not legitimate. So if you limit your sources, then by definition, what you write is going to come out distorted. So in the case of the United States major media, anything that comes out of the Pentagon, the State Department, the White House is automatically legitimate and news. And the assumption is they're telling us the truth. That's the starting assumption. And if there is some high-level ranking Democrat, or at a certain point, you know, people in the French government or the German government who are disagreeing, then you would have the Bush administration says this, and the Democratic Party leadership says this. Well, there's a small problem with that. The Democratic Party leadership in the upper levels had no disagreements with the Bush administration on the Iraq war. They were rah-rah war as well. So if that's the range of your opinion, you've got a pretty narrow range of opinion. One of the reasons that the Bush administration got so upset with the French, you know, as they kind of toughened their resolve to veto a possible, U.S. resolution to support the war in Iraq, that's when we saw the unleashing of the xenophobia against the French. Now, I have to say, I'm used to and expected racism against Arabs and Muslims. We've seen it historically against African Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans. But frankly, I was surprised that they could get this worked up over the French. You know, it's not exactly a minority that threatens, the stability of the United States. But what happened? It's very, very interesting to look at how this happened because of the interplay between the government and the media. We didn't get a bunch of xenophobia against Germans, who also oppose us, right? But why? Because the Germans didn't have a veto power. The French had a veto power in the UN. And therefore, the U.S., Karl Rove in specific, the political Rasputin of the White House, he zeroed in, a strategy to get the media, and specifically pundits, opinion makers, commentary people, and so on, to whip up a sentiment against the French as a way to threaten the French, to show the popular discontent with the French position. And suddenly the same phrases got repeated over, oh, they're surrender monkeys. Oh, we rescued them in World War II. Look how ungrateful they are. Hello? What happened to the French resistance? Some of the French didn't have anything to do with their own liberation during World War II. It was all because of the U.S. largesse, So they distorted history. And then, of course, we had the whole thing about renaming French fries to freedom fries. And, like Woody Allen said, he now has to freedom kiss his wife, and so things got really pretty absurd, right? And I, for one, took a strong stand against and these calls for boycotting the French products, and I purposely went out and bought as much French wine as I could. So that was a perfect example of the interplay of the government and the media in an artificial whipping up of sentiment of xenophobia. And you may not have read about this, even far more dangerous threat that was made. Mexico was going to vote and ultimately did not vote with the U.S. and the U.N. So the U.S. was using every pressure tactic and every bullying effort that it could, from threatening to take away money, to cancel the free trade agreement with Chile. I mean, anything was on the table. And in the case of Mexico, Bush gave a speech, an interview, which was widely reprinted in the Mexican press, that said, look at how the American people are reacting to the French opposition, pointing to all of this whipped up xenophobia from the media here. Think what would happen to Mexicans living in the United States if Mexico were to vote against the U.S. in the U.N. So that, and I'm paraphrasing him here, but that was the gist of the remark. So what he's saying is, we're going to whip up xenophobia and racism in the U.S. against Mexicans if you don't vote with us. That's what the threat was. And for, anybody, we look at things like Rwanda or Yugoslavia, and we think of, my God, look at the horrors. Your people are this horrible ethnic, religious, tribal conflicts and murders and ethnic cleansing, right? Hey, that did not come out of a vacuum. That didn't come out because people hate each other. That came about because opportunistic politicians either wanted to get into power or to stay in power. And they said, keep me in power, kill those X, those bad people, right? That's why Yugoslavia broke apart, and that's why the war, the horrible genocide took place in Rwanda. And think about in the United States in that context, when we've got politicians willing to whip up that kind of xenophobia here, think about what could happen in this country if they start blaming people of color here for siding with the enemy. For example. And we're not there yet, thank God, and I'm not saying we're going to be there tomorrow, but that's the direction in which the leadership of this country could take us if they deem it in their interest to stay in power. And none of this do we see criticized in the media here. A lot of it's not even reported. And you see the basically what happens is reporters engage in self-censorship, that they know that certain stories are never going to get in, certain information is never going to get in, so you don't even bother submitting it to your editor. And that's a thing, that's an almost universal factor in reporting international news. I mean, just the fact that I travel to countries all over the world, and the only stories the editors will take, well, the question is, how does it affect Americans?
You are listening to Reese Ehrlich, author of the book Target Iraq, What the News Media Is Not Telling Us, speaking in Ukiah, California, on June 10th, 2003. This is American Dream Radio.
Well, hey, maybe a story in Chile or Africa, you know, in South Africa or something, doesn't affect Americans, but it's still a really interesting story. And frankly, I think Americans will be interested in it. But I'm still supposed to find some angle that would be of interest in Americans. So right from the get, what does that mean? It means trade. It means U.S. military policy. How did they vote on Iraq? So you've already narrowed, you know, the 1,000 stories that you could report from a story down to about 3 that somehow, by definition, are of interest to the American people, although I don't think that's actually the case. Of course, an important factor is the consolidation of the media, where fewer and fewer rich white men own more and more of the media. And this latest FCC decision, in which it's now legal for newspapers and local TV stations to combine, for more radio stations to be bought up by more conglomerates. So that has several very, very negative. It just compounds the problems that have existed even prior to this. In some cases, in Clear Channel radio stations, they just eliminate the local news altogether. You'll be listening to your local station, you'll have local weather and traffic reports, but the news itself comes out of San Antonio, and it's the same news that's broadcast on all the Clear Channel stations. So they have literally eliminated the news departments at some radio stations or cut them way back at others. They're now starting to do that in television as well, where they have some people in Washington with a backdrop that's the same as the one at the local station, and you've got a bit of local news and weather locally, and then it cuts to Washington to what appears like some other anchors, but they're really, it's the same news that's going out. So it's a very dangerous trend. When there's consolidation, there's usually layoffs, because the company, the big conglomerates, now have to pay off the debt from all this merger stuff, and people start getting nervous for their jobs. The San Francisco Chronicle, if you recall, was just recently purchased by the Hearst Corporation about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and now they're going to have 500 layoffs. They're going to lose 500 jobs at the Chronicle. That's newsroom, truck drivers, layout people, you know, the whole corporate structure. And if you're a reporter or an editor, and you hear that, are you willing to take risks about reporting a controversial story, doing anything that might endanger your job? No, you play it safe. You know, you can write the 115th story about Lacey Peterson, you know, or Chandra Levy, or whatever, that kind of story. That's the safe stuff. That's not going to get you in trouble. Now, at the same time that we see all of these negative developments at the top of the media feeding chain, I see a lot of very encouraging developments down below. So first, just among ordinary people, you know, especially during the Iraq War, and I think it's continued over, there are millions and millions of Americans who simply do not trust the mainstream media, and they're looking somewhere else for their news. So I suspect people in this room and people all over the country, you go to the internet, you go to your community radio station, in some cases you go to your community access station on cable TV if they've got a decent news program. You go to your independent bookseller to find alternative books that might give you. So people are hungry for different information, and they seek it out. So a question I'm often asked, and therefore I've just incorporated it into the talk, well, where do you go to get your news? I read way more newspapers than you'll ever want to think about every day, but you can certainly go to certain websites that help pull together news from other sources, so kind of one or two stop shops, you can get interesting news on a daily basis. So you can subscribe to truthout.org. By the way, all of these are free. Truthout.org is a handy site, about 8-9 stories a day from the mainstream media in the U.S. and Britain, and they will, you can just click on the story if it looks interesting. CommonDreams.org is another good one. ZNet.org. alternet.org, which is the site of the alternative weeklies, and you may have others of your favorites that you want to pass along, but those are some of the better ones that are out there. And then, of course, if you want to check out the British press, for example, the BBC has interesting information that you often don't see here. The Guardian in Britain is also very good there. And all of these the websites of all of these organizations have just gone through the roof since the Iraq War, because there's, and a lot of them are coming from America because people are so disgusted with what they're seeing. I've seen an increase in kind of media activism on a grassroots level, that people are so angry at what the mainstream media are doing. And I would encourage you, even just on an individual level, let alone an organizational one, to start thinking of yourself as a media activist. So what does that mean? Read between the lines. When you read the newspapers, start to learn how to kind of triangulate. You've got Fox News over here, New York Times over here, and The Truth over here. And you know how you triangulate to find a location, right, of a transmitter or something like that? So you kind of figure out, well, Fox News is completely wrong, but they're concerned about this issue. All right, so let's figure that. New York Times is mostly wrong, but they've got some information that might be right. And then, okay, over here, I think I got an idea, and I'll call up Reason to try and figure it out. All right, so we've got that process of reading between the lines and trying to understand as best you can of what is really going on, and of course checking all the various alternative media sites to see what they have to say. Secondly, if you see an article that is particularly bad, so a lot of people just throw up their hands. It's useless. They're not going to do anything. Particularly for your local media, letters to the editor, emails, phone calls do have some impact. I'm a reporter. I've published hundreds of articles, and I can remember the articles that got any response whatsoever. Most articles go out there, there's absolutely no noticeable response from anybody in the public. So if an article, especially a local daily, gets 5 emails or letters about an article, that's like an upsurge of popular sentiment. And if they get 10 letters, that's practically an overwhelming sign of popular unrest. So, do it. Don't do it as a standardized paragraph where everybody sends in the same thing. Write your own honestly felt, well-reasoned letter. It doesn't have to be long. But, send that in, and it can have some impact. Similarly, if you see an article that you like, it's as important to encourage the reporters who are trying to do an honest job by writing in letters of support. Because I know I always get the negative letters about my stuff when it runs in the mainstream media. I've had ambassadors criticize me, whatever. But when, individuals of whatever persuasion write in support, that's very encouraging. And the editors like to see that. Okay, so express your opinions. If you get particularly bad coverage, it's perfectly okay to go in and have meetings with the editors, especially of your local press. This works, well, it can work on any issue, but it will probably be most effective on the local issues that people feel most strongly about. If they're doing a bad job of covering the issues of organic farming or the inordinate number of wineries that seem to be popping up in this area, or development issues or whatever, go in, hold meetings, and they may say at the time, we've been perfectly balanced on this issue. And we get criticized from the other side all the time, and you criticize us, and that just shows us that we're doing the right thing because we get criticized by everybody. That's the standard response. But something? After the meeting, it has an impact, particularly if you're persuasive, if you've got some community backing behind you. You have to approach the media in the same way you would a member of the city council or Congress or anybody else. If your local member of Congress voted for the war, do you just throw up your hands and give up and say no, there's nothing I can do? No, you go down, you pick it, you write letters, you meet with them and try to win them over to the other side. Well, the media is no different. And finally, I describe myself as a sober optimist. And by that I mean I realize that we've gone through a very difficult time, that there's a lot of people who feel that, here we went out, we expended all this effort to oppose the war in Iraq, to oppose the Patriot Act, and they went ahead and they waged this horrible war anyway, and Ashcroft is out trying to get the Patriot Act 2 passed, and gosh, there's nothing we can do. I just kind of throw out my hands. I'll just go back to doing whatever it is I normally do. I know there's people who feel that way. Sorry. But, you know, frankly, I never thought the anti-war movement was going to be strong enough to stop the war. And I said that publicly at the time. That's not a reason to stop protesting or doing something. But basically, Bush had decided he was going to go to war no matter what. As long as he had the backing of the elite in this country, the top leaders of the Democrats, the corporate elite, the military, etc., it didn't really matter what the American people thought, let alone people anywhere else. He was devout and determined to go to war. Now he's paying the consequences for it. And keep in mind that the anti-war movement had a tremendous impact on the ability of this government to wage war. How? The anti-war movement here and in Europe, you know, we saw some of the largest demonstrations in this country since the Vietnam War era. In Britain, they had the largest single demonstration in the history of Britain on any issue. And they really get worked up over fox hunting. That had been the previous biggest demonstration. You know that. And this one trumped that. They got more people out. And by the way, it was pro-fox hunting, which I still can't understand. But anyway, that's the British. And the anti-war movements in France and in Spain, and all over Europe, I'm absolutely convinced strengthened the resolve of the French government and the Russian government to veto or threaten to veto, which completely aced the U.S. out of being able to get the U.N. stamp of legitimacy on the war. The Turkish government refused to allow the U.S. use its bases, which is a tremendous blow, because the U.S. had planned to bring in all kinds of troops from the north in order to invade Iraq from there. And basically, the U.S. was entirely isolated on the war. It was not a coalition effort. It was the United States and Britain, 2,000 troops from Australia, 400 from Poland, and letters of recommendation from everybody else. I mean, that was it. That was the big coalition. And the fact that the U.S. was so isolated means that the U.S. has to pay for the entire war, i.e. us, the taxpayers, at a tremendous cost. It means the U.S. troops have to patrol the streets of Baghdad because they can't get anybody else to go in and do it, which means U.S. troops are going to get shot at and killed. Our men and women in the services are being sacrificed for the glory of the White House and for our oil companies and our Pentagon. And the American people are going to be slowly beginning to understand that what appears to be a victory is going to be, in fact, a long-term bogged-down quagmire, not unlike Vietnam. And I think that the decisive factor is going to be what happens with the economy. And I don't have a crystal ball, but one possibility is that the economy is going to continue to get worse. We now know see that there's 6.1% unemployment. It's gone up slightly. If the economy continues to go bad as a result of this horrific tax reform, which was give lots of money to the rich people and take it away from poor people, plus the continued costs of maintaining a couple hundred thousand troops in Iraq, which is not going to be cheap, the economy may well not turn around. And if you recall, that's what got Bush Sr. out of office in 92. So that is a distinct, I'm not saying that will happen, but that's a distinct possibility, and no small amount is up to what kind of candidate the Democrats put forward. If they put forward another pro-war candidate, it's going to be quite problematic because not all that many people are going to be enthusiastic. But, you know, it's not over. And I, for one, can see that there's going to be a growing dump Bush movement in this country, and that the well-honed plans of invading Afghanistan, then invading Iraq, and then on to Iran or whatever is not going to happen. I mean, the Bush administration is having far more problems than they plan. And if people get out and organize and continue and build the movement, I, for one, can see the possibility of regime change in Washington in November. Thanks. Thank you very much. Okay, I just wanted to start.
You are listening to Reese Ehrlich, author of the book Target Iraq, What the News Media is Not Telling Us, speaking in Ukiah, California on June 10th, 2003. This is American Dream Radio.
Be happy to take questions. Yeah.
Well, I would love nothing more. I'd like to see the regime change, Bush is going to be able to raise a huge amount of money. He's going to raise enormous levels of money. Generally, the person who raises the most money wins.
Yeah, the question is that Bush is going to be able to raise more money than the other folks, and the person who raises the most money usually wins. Not always. And that's why I think it depends in part on what Democrat is nominated and how much popular grassroots support can be generated, because there is tremendous opposition to the war, opposition to the Patriot Act. You know, the opposition to the war was highest among African Americans on a percentage basis. People of color in this country did not support this war. They hate Bush, along with whole lots of other folks. And the potential, the unions, you know, I mean, the AFL-CIO voted to oppose the war. You know, I'm old enough to remember as a union activist trying to get my union local to oppose the Vietnam War. I was called some kind of a communist and everything else, right? So there have been tremendous changes in this country. So that is certainly a problem. And the Republicans right now are very confident that Bush is going to not have any problems. And that's why they've scheduled the convention late, you know, and they just plan that's just kind of this march straight to the presidency. But I still think that if the grassroots activists in this country can be mobilized and tap into that sentiment of people who don't normally vote, get people to register to vote, to get out there, then I think there's a strong chance he can be defeated. And if the economy goes sour, stays sour.
Well, what about,
yeah, great.
What about the spear tactics? I mean, they seem to have worked out. You have the red and the orange and the different levels, and people are so critical. I know at least four or five people I thought they're afraid they go to San Jose or San Francisco, and they're going to be attacked by terrorists. And it just seems like the Bush administration is able to, red, level it, and just sort of get people here or not. I think that.
What's with all these alerts anyway? I think it probably varies by community and by individuals. Most people I talk to haven't got a clue as to what all these alert levels mean as a practical matter. And you're supposed to go out and buy more duct tape, I guess. I'll put your hands down. I'll be happy to call you in a sec. I think for sure they use these alerts for political reasons, because they never do explain on what basis they have any intelligence to indicate that there's more of a threat. There hasn't actually been any terrorist attacks or anything close to it at the times when they've raised the alert or lowered it or anything else. Well, just like they couldn't tell us about the weapons of mass destruction either. So I think what it is, it's used for political advantage. You notice the scare level, the alert level went up at the time of the beginning of the war. So that for sure was designed to get people, watch your neighbors, watch for them dark-skinned Arab Muslim types because they may be terrorists, for sure. I've seen absolutely no practical benefit from that alert system anywhere. Yeah. Did you have anything?
Yeah. I think that scare tactics goes back 50 years ago during the Cold War, and I just watched a TV program Sunday. It was called Code in Orange Show. I don't know if you guys watched it. It had to do with this guy getting murdered, I think it was the CIA, and I guess he dealt with bacteria.
Bacteriological.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question. That's the great hypocrisy of the U.S. saying, weapons, these countries have weapons of mass destruction. I mean, what country in the world has the largest arsenal of weapons of mass destruction in the entire world? The United States, right? And we've used them. Right? What was Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Not only that, the U.S. has, at Fort Detrick, Maryland, a massive supply of chemical and biological weapons for defensive purposes only, for research only. We would never, ever think of using this stuff offensively. I want you to rest assured, or we'll go up to an orange alert level. It's ironic that after the anthrax attacks, Remember? Which, by the way, has anybody heard of anything, anybody being rounded up for that one? Right? That one dropped off the map the minute they figured out it was some white lab scientist that was responsible for it. Oh, can't be a very serious threat. But in the beginning, before anybody knew, you know, who was responsible, who might have been responsible, there was, remember, they were saying it was the Iraqis. Okay, now how did they know it was the Iraqis? Well, you know, we know now how they knew. Well, actually, as it turns out, how they knew, they didn't know. Am I getting too complicated here? Here's what happened. The U.S. in the 80s sent anthrax to Iraq, along with other biological weapons, all for research purposes, right? And they knew exactly what strain had been sent to Iraq. And they knew, because they knew it was being sent there so that it could be weaponized. Because in those days, Saddam Hussein was an ally with the U.S. against the evil, evil mullahs of Iran, who were the Hitler of the day, right? We keep changing Hitler's month by month. So in those days, Iran was the big enemy, so Iraq, it was okay. So the U.S. actually sent the precursor elements for biological weaponry to Iraq, and so when the anthrax showed up in Florida and other places, they could go back and they could trace it. Is it the same strain? It turns out it wasn't. That's how they knew Iraq wasn't behind the anthrax, and it did come from Fort Detrick. So it came from inside the U.S. chemical weapons, biological weapons establishment somewhere. And that's when the whole publicity around it has dropped.
Yeah, and this came up 50 years. What's going to happen? You know, what is going to find out 50 years from now about, you know, this situation here?
Stay tuned. Have me come back. Okay. Yes, here.
Yes.
Yes.
And I heard on your show that when the bombers, the suicide bombers for 9/11, they were actually in camera at that time. Mm-hmm. And it was an FBI agent who was all along with them. They knew everything about it. And also when the three other country agencies informed the United States, they also ignored, except the Israelis on their floor was back. Empty,
Well, I think that we do not know the full extent of the intelligence lapses that took place prior to 9/11. That's one of the reasons the Bush administration doesn't even want the congressional investigation that was done released in full form. We know certain things. We know that there was an FBI agent in Texas who had gotten word about Arab nationals training as pilots in suspicious circumstances. We know a few things like that. But I know what you're talking about. I don't think it was an FBI agent. I think there was an informer. The problem was, I don't think the White House had gotten, or any intelligence agency, firm information that a terrorist attack was planned, that people were going to send planes into the World Trade Center. They may have gotten general chatter about the, you know, possible terrorist attacks, but they get that all the time. I do not think, I've not seen any evidence, and I've read this stuff very closely, that the Bush administration knew in advance of 9/11 that the planes were going to crash into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and let it go ahead in order to stir up popular sentiment in this country to do everything that they've done. I think they opportunistically took advantage of that when it happened. And if, you know, I mean, one thing that in all of these theories that I've heard, why would the administration intentionally allow a plane to crash into the Pentagon, kill 90 officers, including a lieutenant general? You know, the U.S. is capable of doing bombings, agent provocateur bombings, but they kill civilians. They kill, innocent bystanders. They do not blow up their own headquarters in order to prove that they're that there's this enemy. I just don't buy it. I just haven't seen the evidence to show that. Yeah, here.
How do you know
Yeah, the question is, do they, various countries in the Middle East have any way to stop the United States from invading them? Yeah, actually they do. It's called popular resistance. You know, the United States only invades countries that it thinks it can walk in and take over with no resistance. It's the classic bully mentality, which is, you know, we can go in and because your military has been weakened by 10, 12 years of sanctions, we can go in and take over your country in Iraq. Or your army, your armored divisions consist of pickup trucks in Afghanistan, we can take care of you, right? But let's just take Iran for a moment. You know, I'm a strong opponent of the right-wing clergy that are the dominant faction within Iran. I have I've seen firsthand from visiting there, it's a repressive reactionary regime. But there's lots of people in Iran fighting against that. But they have popular support, and they've got a military. And if the U.S. tried to invade Iran, it would make Iraq look like what's going on in Iraq now look like a picnic. Because every Iranian would pick up a gun and start shooting at the U.S., whether they were pro, you know, whatever faction they were involved in, and the U.S. would have serious, serious problems. So that's why the U.S. is not about to invade Iran tomorrow. Because even they know that. And they ain't the same reason they ain't going to invade North Korea. Because, you know, so Syria, I think they would certainly have problems. Actually, this is a bit more problematic in Syria. I mean, but they're certainly not going to invade a country that where there would be a popular resistance. And the people of those countries know that.
Oh, I just wanted to, we know that solution, the people in power, it's time for regime change. And the Democrats didn't seem to stop the Republicans from joining in through this war. So which party do we support now? You know, is the Green Party the answer?
Yeah.
Or I've heard somebody in New York mentioning another party called the Innovators, focusing more on renewable energy solutions.
Yeah.
Have you heard of this party?
What about the Democrats? What about a third party and so on? It's a tough problem. I'll just tell you my own perspective for whatever it's worth. I'm not out there organizing for any particular party or whatever. My perspective is I think it really is important to defeat Bush. And that on the national level. I think we can work for local candidates, Green Party candidates, other independent candidates, progressive Democrats. That's important because in the next election, and election after that, or whatever, we've got to build a movement from below to the point at the national level where we don't have to accept this set of Tweedledee and Tweedledum. What I would hope to see is a strong showing by an anti-war candidate in the Democratic Party in the primaries. Because whether or not Kucinich or Carol Moseley Brown or Al Sharpton, all of whom, by the way, are strongly anti-war, whether or not they win the nomination, if there's a strong vote in their support, it's going to send a message to whoever does win the nomination, that you can't take the progressive forces for granted. Then let's say those one or another, or even Howard Dean, although I don't think he's genuinely anti-war or progressive, but let's say none of those people win, and you've got a Kerry or somebody like that running against Bush. Then I think we have, and then I want to see who the Green Party is going to run. Right? Then I'm going to make a choice. I'm not going to let the Democrats take me for granted and say, oh, because I hate Bush, I have to vote for the Democrat if they're going to carry out the same policies. If there's a significant enough difference, I'll vote for the Democrat even though I disagree with them on other stuff. I respect people who voted for Ralph Nader the last time around because Al Gore and Bush didn't offer that much difference. So I think it's a tactical vote, a decision you have to make at the time. But the real issue is going to be organizing at the grassroots local level so that we don't constantly face the same problem on the statewide and national level. Yes, in the back.
We talked about how reporters engage in self-censorship as one reason to explain why we see such narrow opinions expressed in the press. How do you explain the colleagues who were all in favor or who supported the U.S.'s right to change the government in the other country?
How do I explain? Yeah.
How do you explain that? That the people that you met with were here.
Yeah.
They were all in favor of,
well,
supporting the U.S.
I mean,
that has nothing to do with your editors.
Right. How do I explain the fact that people accept the assumptions of empire and that the U.S. has the right to change the government around? Well, I think it reflects an ideological bias in the that is reflected in the elite that runs this country, of whom these folks are either part of or aspiring to be part of. And what that means is the old idea of national sovereignty, that countries have the right to select their own leaders independent of outside interference, that's just flown out the window. Because we can do it because we're the superpower and we're for democracy and everybody has to accept that. What can I say? It's an ideological bias. Why is there so much racism among these same folks? You know, subtle sometimes, overt sometimes, but it's all there. Because they're the ones who, the people who don't agree with that, don't rise to the top in the profession. They either are at a lower level, or they're like me, they're freelancers, or, you know, working around the edges. I could not work on a day-to-day basis in the New York Times and express the views that I am today. It's simply, no matter how accurate, brilliant my reporting might be, no matter what great sources I might get and risks I take, they would not allow it in. It's that simple. Okay. I'm going to take just a couple more questions, and then we'll call it. Yeah.
I saw on a segment a month or two ago on the Al Gore Mortars, as far as I'm concerned, that show on TV.
Yeah.
Friday night is basically an excellent show. But they had, I forgot the gentleman's name, he was the publisher, the editor of Publisher Magazine.
Oh, yeah, I know who you mean. Okay. He'll come back to me a second.
He was talking to him, and Bill was saying something to him about how the media kind of censors the stories and they don't report the stories. And one of the responses he had really interested me. And I haven't made sense of it all yet, but I'm really trying to explore it. And then what he was saying was that he's not sure if the media really pulls that stuff away or if the American people really resist hearing it. Mm-hmm. He says a lot of these stories mm-hmm. aren't reported, but not what people want to hear, so they just mm-hmm.
Well, for sure, the excuse that editors and reporters use is that if we publish this, we would be isolated. People don't want to hear that. Absolutely, that's the excuse they use. Now, I talk a lot on AM radio. I actually do get out, and I don't just speak to groups like this. I'm speaking to the Rotary Club in Oakland in a couple of days, you know. So there are lots of people with other opinions, and there are lots of people who distrust the media and think that it's got a liberal bias. That they hate the media. They agree with me that the media is all distortions, and it's way too liberal. Everybody knows that. Okay, right? And they say, look at all the favorable coverage of the anti-war movement. You know, and so they've got their set of little shibboleths and claims and so on. All right. And that's why it's important to note that the media is a transmission belt for those in power, but it is not starting, it's along the belt, but it's not the force putting it onto the belt. It's the administration, it's the Pentagon, it's the corporations who are using the media to get their ideas out. But a lot of people don't believe what they read in the media. I mean, I publish articles all the time that have a slant that I think is accurate and true and doesn't follow the mainstream line, and people aren't rising up as a result of reading, oh, now we understand the truth, you know. I'm sure a lot of people discount what I write as being a bunch of liberal bias and so on. Okay, so it's a tricky issue. That's why change in the media is part of the problem, but we've got to organize at the grassroots to change people's ideas as well, because I think some of those people, and that's why talking on AM radio is interesting, because there's a segment out there of folks who are isolationists, who are so far to the right that they hate Bush and his policies. There's people who, you know, remember that whole thing, it wasn't long ago that the right wing was all inflamed about Waco and Ruby Ridge and the taking away of their rights. Well, hello, aren't your rights being taken away now? You know? So, but there are people who are angry about that. And I think, not the leadership, not the Pat Buchanan types, but get out. I think especially in towns like Ukiah, I'm sure everyone knows somebody, you know, with kind of these inclinations. You know, talk to them and get them get them angry at the right people. It's not the immigrants and the minorities that are the problem. It's the people in power. It's the people running the corporations that are in power. And I think, so part of it has to be organizing at the grassroots. Because to some extent it is true that the media publishes stuff that they think people are going to go with. And if we change what people think, it's going to force the media to be more accurate as well. Okay, I'll tell you what, I'm going to continue. I'll be happy to talk with you afterwards. Come on up, buy the books. We'll continue the conversation. Thanks very much for coming tonight.
You've been listening to Reese Ehrlich, co-author with Norman Solomon of the book Target Iraq, What the News Media is Not Telling Us. Published January 2003 by Context Press. This talk was given on June 10th, 2003 in Ukiah, California. This is an original production of American Dream Radio. Find us on the web at americandreamradio.org.